So, tonight's lecture, and tonight's lecturer, Peter Macklin, which almost as you know, in any case, but he's provided me with a bio, which I haven't had time to study, so I'm just going to read it and show it to you. No. Peter Macklin is principal of Peter Macklin Associates, a specialist acoustic consultancy based in Colchester, specialises in the field of room acoustics, electroacoustics, and sound system design. He has degrees in applied physics and acoustics, and is a fellow of the Engineering Society. He's been responsible for the design and commissioning over 450 sound systems, going from concert halls and theatres to churches, arenas, stadiums, airports, and other transportation terminals. He's also known for his extensive research work relating to speech intelligibility and audio conduction loop systems from Harvard Hearing. Peter is a contributing author to a number of international acoustics and audio reference books, and is currently a convener of IEC 60268-16, the sound relating to the measurement of STI and speech intelligibility, and is responsible to producing the next revision of the standard. Should that be for one?
Probably.
Yeah, probably. Peter is currently working on a range of projects, including the new Lansdowne Road Stadium in Dublin, Winchester Cathedral, Trinity College Chapel, Cambridge, three theatres, and no fewer than 10 underground railway stations. And he tells me that tonight's lecture aims to fix the whole of audio, so I think you can
be your ears. Hey, Keith. If I should fall asleep halfway through, if somebody could wake me up, I'm still managed to get jet lag from New York last week. I don't know why, it just got me. Okay. The idea, I cunningly thought of this a while ago, was to give the paper I was going to give in New York, and it would save me a lot of work. The trouble is I didn't actually get around to doing the work and give the paper in New York, so what I had to do is come up with something a little bit different. That was going to be about bass sound in particular, and now I do actually talk about it a little bit. So this is really the background. But the thing that really interests me was that a lot of people say they want high-quality sound. And I've seen it in dozens of specifications that come across my desk, and I think, well, what is high-quality sound? And I really wanted to try and have a look at that. It's very different as to whether it's in hi-fi or home theatre type thing, a professional commercial theatre or a cathedral or a railway station. They all want high quality, but actually the difference in quality is quite dramatic. I really wanted to look at some of those aspects. And therefore, hence the thing, measuring and predicting what we hear. So one of the questions we'll ask is, what is high quality sound? How can we objectively measure and assess it? Because the trouble is these days we're getting very contractual, and if I have a contract that says I have to deliver high quality sound, I can go and say, well, I think it's high quality, and somebody else can have an argument, and therefore some of this work is related to that. How do I predict it before we even get to that stage? Again, like these 10 railway stations I'm working on, we have to predict exactly that they are going to meet certain criteria. They have to be a certain level of intelligibility, believe it or not, for railway stations these days. And if it doesn't meet it, I could get sued. So I have a vested interest in understanding what it's about. So that's what we're going to talk about. And I've come up with these four kind of areas that I think would help describe sound quality. There's obviously the timbre and the frequency response, there's the information content, and it doesn't matter if it's speech or music, there's information there. There's spatial information and distortion. So we've got, with timbre, we've got bandwidth and frequency response. Information will be clarity and intelligibility. Spatial will be directionality, localization. Is that correct? And then obviously distortion would be non-linear to typical distortion you and I talk about, but also I'm going to talk about temporal distortion, things that go on in the time domain that screw things up for us. And hopefully that would all come together and give us this idea in the listening area, we need uniformity of coverage and uniformity of whatever parameter it is we want to do. So that's the idea. So let's have a look at some of the systems, from hi-fi, cinema, theatres, paging systems and life. Life safety voice alarm systems. This one is becoming really crucial these days. There are several standards we have to meet if we're doing a life safety system. Any public building now in the UK, if it's a new one or has a major refurb, has to have a life safety system, a voice alarm system. It doesn't have bells and whistles anymore. You actually have to tell people what's going on. Obviously, the normal speech and hearing range is quite useful to know. Music, I don't know what, 40 hertz up to 10 kilohertz, and then all the harmonics and other information up to, what, 96 kilohertz, I guess, if you believe various people, or at least 40, 46. Speech typically from about 100 up to 5 kilohertz in terms of its main area of information, but certainly extending the bandwidth well beyond that has a massive improvement in terms of quality, as we all know. But it actually has very little effect on in terms of intelligibility, which is kind of interesting. The two are not the same. Some of the standards, I don't want to go linger too long on these, but there are standards around that help us. There's a BS6259, which is a code of practice for sound systems. Obviously, Dolby and THX have come up with standards and requirements for their systems and standardise it. Infocom is working on a standard. That's the American Contractors and Installers Association. EN54 is a killer. This is a voice alarm or fire alarm standard that's becoming European-wide. And every loudspeaker, for example, that goes into a voice alarm system will have to meet this standard. It'll have to be tested and shown to meet that standard. It's not like a CE mark. But it's going to cost something between 10, 15, 20,000 quid to measure every speaker, you know, each speaker. And half the tests are totally irrelevant, but that's a different issue. Clarity and intelligibility, there's no point having a sound system unless it's going to be intelligible or it's clear in terms of what it's amplifying. And there are standards there. The emergency life standards, 60849 is going away, but that's a life safety standard. 724 is the one that's placing it, it's an ISO. And then this one is actually a British standard that was designed for sports stadiums that came about really after Hillsborough. It's just being revised at the moment to bring it up to date. Localization and distortion, I don't really see any standards. There's very little written about what you need in terms of those. So I'm going to steer clear of that tonight. I've got enough to talk about as it is. If we look at 6259, it has three kind of categories of system. You have a minimum 400 to 4 kilohertz. That certainly gives you intelligibility. Reasonable, they call it, is 150 to 6 kilohertz. And I guess, you know, for a lot of PA systems, that would not be unreasonable if you could achieve that. And then high quality would be 100 hertz to 10k plus. That's the minimum. You know, that's quite low in some respects, but actually it's not too bad. Needless to say, 6259 has been rewritten. It came out years ago and needs updating. 7827, the sports ground stadium, actually goes a little bit more detail. It actually gives you a bandwidth of 300 to 6K plus or minus 5. None of the other standards actually give you any tolerance or any requirement. They just say you have to do this. And as you can see later on, some of the systems I'm going to show you may or may not meet some of those standards, depending. As I said, some of the cinema curves, we've had cinema curves for years. Typical one, you know, reasonably flat from 80 hertz up to 2 kilohertz. And then we get this roll-off. And the roll-off intrigues me, and it's taken me a long time to work out some of this stuff, and I'll be talking about that a bit later on. Why would you not have a flat frequency response? You know, why doesn't it go to 15K or whatever? This is the in-room measured system response. That's the point. And I can show you exactly why that occurs later on. Over the years, there have been speech EQ house curves have derived. And people try and meet these, and sometimes they work, sometimes it sounds diabolical if you do that. Really does. And you have to understand what happened. This curve came about because it seemed to work, but nobody could have understood why. When you understand what's really going on, you can understand why this curve works sometimes and why it doesn't. And I can show you curves that are completely different to that. Let's talk about it. And it really depends on how you do the measurement. Because we, you know, we talk about frequency response, but how do we measure it? Do we use a steady state, you know, pink noise with a real-time analyzer of some sort? Or do we use a rather more clever thing with a time-selective or time-weighted analyzer where we really look at the impulse response and then see what we do with the sound that way? Because you're going to get different answers. And again, I'll show you some of those later on. And that really is the crux of it, because there's no analyzer out there yet that will tell me A, what the frequency response that we're listening to actually is. You know, I can measure it all sorts of different ways, but none of them actually said this is what you hear. And that's one of my contentions. Maybe some of the stuff I'm going to talk about tonight will lead us that way. If we look at the traditional real-time analyzer, these are super. I mean, I've got a really nice little portable one. I use it all the time now. It's fantastic. Take it everywhere. And I get an octave, third octave, or 24-octave display. Really useful, and I would be lost without that. It's really useful. I spend a lot of my time working on large systems, be it a cathedral, be it a football stadium. You can't have a cable where you plug it in and actually then take it up to the top of the stands some 400 metres away in about an hour to get the cable there to do the one measurement. You know, it's not on. Yes, you can use radio mics, but then you find you've got companion problems and all sorts of things if you run into that. So actually measuring some of these systems is quite tricky, but I spend a lot of my time working. So if we can have a wireless, in every sense of the word, system, that makes life a lot easier. With some skill, you can start to understand what the display is telling you. And it depends if you're in the direct or reverberant field as to what you actually start seeing. And there's been a huge debate, in certainly in the USA, about how you measure systems, whether you should use a time selective or a real-time analyzer. What 90% of the people didn't realize was that even when they were using a time selective analyzer, they're actually doing it steady state and getting the same answers a real-time analyzer would have given you. They just didn't understand what they were measuring, and that's not uncommon. The other nice thing about using pink noise or something is that we can listen to it while we're tweaking around. You can find dead spots, you can see if there's hot spots, you can see what's going on, you've got distortion or whatever, so that's really rather useful. Measurement microphones, less of an issue these days. And you can hear some interesting phase and cone filtering effects that are going on as well. So it's a very nice technique, actually. And it's the same in a small room. You know, you can still hear these things. But of course, you're working with a steady state. You know, you put the pink noise in and you let it run. I might let it run for an hour or so in some of these places. So I think we've achieved steady state, even fully reverberant space. Because what's happening is we're charging up the room, if you think about it. You know, the sound starts up, builds up, depending on the reverberation time, achieves steady state, and then if we stop it, then we're going to get the decay. So we can measure the reverberation time, for example, on that part. But a lot of people forget that you're actually going to charge up the room for a few milliseconds, maybe 50 milliseconds, might be 100, might be 200 or 300, might be longer than that. And the point is, that's what the speech and music are doing. It's this build-up. They don't, you know, when I'm talking, when I'm playing music, I'm not going to charge the room up to the steady state for most of the time. Nice slow symphony or a nice long organ note certainly will do it, but very few things actually do. Speech is very impulsive. And then we come down to saying, okay, I can measure a sound field. I can split it up into different components. I can measure the direct sound. Well, I could if my laser worked. I can measure the direct sound direct from the speaker. Easy, okay. We know what that should be on the whole. I can measure the early reflections, the things that are bouncing straight off the wall. These are usually generally helpful for intelligibility. I can measure, if I want, the later reflections, the things that start to screw intelligibility up. You know, after 100 milliseconds, 120 milliseconds, you don't want strong reflections. That will screw intelligibility quite nicely. And then we've got the reverberant field, or the reverberation coming in. So there are four components that we need to do. And somewhere the ear is going to measure some component, you know, somehow it says, out of that lot, I actually hear the frequency response. And it's really some combination of the direct and the early. But in fact, it's more complicated than that. It actually isn't a linear process. It's not saying I measure the first 50 milliseconds. It's frequency dependent. And there's very little research and very few people really understand what that frequency and time dependency is. Because that would be really handy if we could stick that in an analyzer. So by using some selective analyzer, as I'll show you, we can actually change this window and decide, well, how much of the reflected sound do I allow in to influence what I'm hearing? And this is where your eye and your ear start to work, you know, and in tandem, as we're going to see. As I say, the window could be fixed or it could be sliding in time. So that way, we're now into a much more complicated process. We're going to measure the impulse response by some means. That doesn't mean we have to go bang or click, although those are very good. We may do a sine sweep and deconvolve it. We might use a maximum length sequence and do a cross-correlation on it, but we end up with an impulse response that we can then post-process and manipulate. Now I can take this thing and actually look at different windows. I can do a fixed window, I can do a sliding window, and come up with different responses from it. And that's really quite handy. The question is, what? Well, there's an example. It's not a particularly brilliant system. It's a PA system somewhere. And if I looked at the direct and early, it's reasonably flat. You know, it gets up to about 6 kilohertz, so it meets our kind of criteria, drops off a bit. But then the reverberant is quite different. And of course, we're going to hear some combination of the two. And what we hear, it turns out, it depends on the reverberation time and the size of the space. So I can't even say, well, this is what you need to do, because it's different for different spaces and different reverberation times. So it really is quite a complicated issue to measure something as simple as what is the frequency response. you know, what should we be having, or what should I be specifying, or what have I got to achieve? Say fixed windows, maybe you use 35 to 50 milliseconds, that's quite logical, there's justification. Well, it'll work at mid and high frequencies, not the base. Others use a sliding window, maybe 500 milliseconds at 100 hertz, and going up to, you know, 7 milliseconds at 10k in some non-linear process. That again is another logical way, but you'll get a completely different answer. So there's no standardisation on this, and if there was, we didn't know what it should be anyway. So let's look at some typical responses. I say we've got these house curves, which you can take with a pinch of salt. There's a typical speaker. It's a nice flat hi-fi speaker. The bump is the room, not the speaker. But, you know, that's what I started with. Now we stick that into a space. That's exactly the same speaker now measured in a large-ish, about twice the size of this room, space. It's no longer flat. You know, it was dead flat to start with. Now we've got this HF roll-off. And that's because that is what, you know, it's still the direct sound coming out the speaker is flat. It's now the room and all the reflections coming in affecting the overall response I hear. And that's why we have these roll-off curves, to actually start to take some of this into account. And it really does depend on the power response and the, it's a bit more than the power response, but an angle of listening response, if you like, of the loudspeakers to what that will do. And that's predictable. That really is quite predictable. So we can put that speaker in the space and work out what it will do. So it does need to be controlled. Here's another one. This is a system response, a distributed loudspeaker system in a room about this size. I can make this go dead flat from 100 up to 10k. I could have just tweaked this bit if I wanted to. There was no real need. Everybody said, you're mad doing that. It'll sound dreadful. No, it sounded fantastic in that room because I had a totally full bandwidth. It was hi-fi from a PA system because in that room I could do that. Put that speaker somewhere else. I may not want to have it that response, but in that particular room, I could do it. All right, let's go even one bigger. This is a cathedral, 4.5 seconds rev time. Again, people say, you can't possibly have a response like that in a cathedral. You've got to take the bottom end out, you've got to suck hell out of it, otherwise you've got no intelligibility. You'll roll off the top, you've got to put peaks in it. No, you don't. If you put a decent loudspeaker in, design it properly, know what you're doing, then you end up with a response like this, and it sounds flipping marvellous. I mean, and I won't tell you where it is, but you can go and listen. And I'm really pleased with it. It took a lot of effort. It was not cheap, but it wasn't hyper-expensive either. It's just using the right speaker in the right place. And we've got this extension going down to, you know, 50 hertz. It's got two subwoofers in it. Because they use, this cathedral is used for not just speech, they have conferences, they have a music festival every year. They want to use the system. They have 1,500, 1,600 people come and listen to this thing. It's an incredibly well-used space. And that's what's happening now in cathedrals. It's not just a speech system. They have to do more than they do. And, you know, it is not easy to do this. Don't get it wrong. You know, there's a fair bit of skill, a lot of luck. I hope you'll get sued. But you can do this. You know, there's no reason for having a bad frequency response anymore in any environment. This is another cathedral I'm sort of working on. And that's the current system. And actually, it's not that bad if you measure it. There's a peak here, 250, which you really do hear. You also hear this suck out about 2.5k. But, you know, it's reasonably flat. Then there's no real HF. It is very MIDI when you listen to it. It's a typical kind of cathedral kind of system. It's all right, but it's MIDI and it's honky and it, you know, it needs replacing. 15 years ago, it was all right. Now it isn't. And they've realised that. And it's going to cost them 80 to 100,000 to put a new one in. It's not cheap. I'll tell you what, with the controls and everything else on the back of it. And there's going to be about 50 or 60 decent loudspeakers in there as well, to give you an idea of the size of this place. The other thing you can see is, in fact, you know, there's no low end at all. It rolls off after 200, so it does sound MIDI and honky. No good for music at all. You really wouldn't want to put music through this, and they do have a music festival, and they want to be able to do that sort of thing. And the other thing is, you can see these measurements were made along the nave. There's about, 8, 9 positions. But in fact, they're all within a very narrow bandwidth. In fact, the coverage is actually very good. Well, maybe it wasn't, actually, but that's a whole different story, because that's how I measured it. If we measure it now with the time-selective analyzer, you can see that's the same response. The blue curve is actually showing that. So I can do the same with my real-time as that. There's my blue curve. This is probably what we hear. This is a windowed measurement of the frequency response. Now there's absolutely nothing below 200 Hz, you can see. You really don't hear anything at all. But it's reasonably flat. You can see there's a 5 dB peak at about 600, which you really hear. You certainly hear this big suck out now at 2.5K, no question. But actually, it's not that bad. It's just a question of how you measure it. Interesting question. Here's another one. The red curve is kind of a raw. This is the most ridiculously reverberant space I've ever heard. I mean, it's 11 seconds-ish. You measure it with a calendar rather than any other instrument. It's probably a Roman one as well, kind of that. But anyway. And it was totally, utterly unintelligible. When you look at the speakers and the space, you go, I'm not surprised. But the space changes when it's used, so things are different. But we could equalise it and tweak it, and actually, that's not a bad curve when we finish with it. That was all right, quite pleased with that. It sounded an awful lot better. But what was interesting, if you use a real-time analyzer to do this, you suddenly realise it's not sounding very good, but it hasn't changed very much. And as you change filters and things, the sound changed, but the measurement didn't. And after a while, you go, no, I've gone too far, and I'll put it back. Again, let's now do some time-selective measurements on it. So there's my real-time analyzer type approach. It actually had some windowing in it. And as I window more and more, that's actually a 60 millisecond window. Wow! Now I can hear why there was nothing going on. Now, you didn't hear that one. You may have heard the black one. And so this is why we've definitely got this time frequency window that we need to apply. If only I knew what it was. If I just have to use my ears, unfortunately. But if I could make one of these, it would be quite useful. Otherwise, for considering the space, and that's actually a paging PA system, it's not bad. Just totally unintelligible, but that's a whole different thing. Now, the reason we tweak about responses is you stick a monitor, this is an absolutely dead flat monitor speaker, stick it next to a wall, and as you all know, you get cone filtering, you get response dips and things. Some of these we can sort out. We can sort out the peak there and peak there. We can't sort out the dips. But that happens all the time. We put speakers on walls. That's where they have to go. So these things are absolutely there. Have to do it. This was a little column loudspeaker. It was beautifully designed. I took it apart. Engineering, I thought, this is going to be fantastic. Somebody knows what they're talking about. It was one of the worst sounding systems I've ever designed. And that's why, because of this. One side screwed around and equalised it the hell out of it. I actually made it quite intelligent, and it actually sounded up all right. But I was absolutely shattered when you turn the system on, how bad it was. And it sounded like that, all MIDI. No LF, that's fine, because it was a speech system. These things happen. This is in a corridor. I mean, yeah, I work in corridors as well. But you look at this thing. Again, if you look at the response of the loudspeaker from the manufacturer, you measure it normally, it's reasonably flat. It doesn't have a 15, 20 dB peak in it at 200 or 300 Hz. That's the fact of where it's on the wall, it's in the corridor. It screws up the response. So we have to take the room into account. And this is a very common speaker you see mounted on a wall. The wall completely screws it, and they sound disgusting. So these things happen. Now this is my prize. This is the worst sounding sound system I've ever heard, and I've heard a few. You can see it barely gets to 1.5 kHz bandwidth. It's got a massive peak here at 10 dB at 400 Hz, and it is totally and utterly unintelligible, and it's in a big reverberant space, and this was the emergency sound system. This was the one that told you to get the heck out of this building because certain things were being made and done in this building that you don't want to know about. And I didn't. I was very relieved when I got out having measured this. I mean, you cannot inherently design a system that bad. I think you take skill to do that. Over 25 years, I'd never achieved that. Or even 30 these days. But it happens, and these still happen all the time. Again, looking at responses, I'm interested in making sure that everybody gets the same sound. So in a room like this, I want to make sure everybody gets the front row, back row, gets pretty similar sound. And there are ways of doing it. Again, at the high end, if you do it, this is a distributed sinning system. It's pretty minimal, the variation. The bottom end will vary around, depending on where you go. That's the room. There's not much you can do about it, as we'll see. And you can smooth and you can twig it around a bit. You can see what goes on there. I mean, you've got, what, 1 or 2 dB variation right throughout the room. But down the bottom end, it's 4 or 5 or 6. Okay? That's what it does. But that's a good example of a distributed system. I'd like the top end to be a little bit flatter. But if you go too much, it sounds really bright and horrible. You just don't want to do that. So, again, and then somebody says, well, I want this flat. No, you don't. Not in this case. Other cases, you might. And that's the whole point. This is a concert hall with a really nice music system in it. And there, now you can see the variation across the whole of the stalls in various positions. It's only about 3 or 4 dB. We've achieved what we want. But the bass rise is very intentional, and it's very interesting when you look at music systems. Most of them that I'm going to show you all have a bass rise from about, well, it could be starting anywhere from 400 or 500 down. We're all going to peak the bass up. Why? Because it sounds right, it sounds better. And this is true of even smaller rooms as well, which is quite interesting. And this is really the talk I was going to give, was all about this, but we'll do the background to it. Yes, it has to do with equal loudness, depends on the level that you play the sound at. Absolutely true. And if you look at that curve, and if you look at, say, take the 100 Fon curve, 100 dB, if we're only going to play this system back at 85, 90, you can see that we're going to want a 10 dB increase. It's not unreasonable to make it kind of sound flat. But the room, the reverberation time, may be doing something similar as well. So you kind of think you get a double whammy. Reverberation time brings me on to clarity and intelligibility. We need adequate bandwidth, we need adequate frequency response to be able to do that. We want decent signal to noise ratio. Well, actually, we want a pretty indecent signal to noise ratio to make it intelligible. To make it quality, you want a decent signal to noise ratio. I can get away with 6 dB signal to noise ratio and it'd be intelligible. 10 is what we probably aim for in an industrial building, and 15, we're over the moon. So I don't think you'd like to listen to a 15 dB signal noise ratio, but you would on a PA system. It would be intelligible. And that's the difference between quality and intelligibility. They are very, very different. We want an adequate direct to reverberant ratio. In other words, I want enough direct sound and less reflective, over the reverberant and reflective. That has to be enough. That's quite predictable. We'll do that. And we need to be free from echoes. That really isn't too difficult to do. And obviously we want to be free from distortion. Well, we know what free from distortion, but again, any decent system these days really shouldn't be distorting too much. So for intelligibility, we need at least 400 to 4 kilohertz. That's a telephone bandwidth effectively. That's pretty intelligible. Doesn't sound very nice, but it's intelligible. As I say, a signal to noise ratio, 10 dBA is kind of an often recommended design goal for a paging system or a life safety system. And it's remarkably difficult to even achieve 10 dBA in a lot of spaces. And in fact, what's happening is on London Underground, for example, the systems achieve that, and they now have neighbourhood noise nuisance problems. And in fact, London Underground were taken to court last year for causing a statutory nuisance from their PA system. Had they done something about it, they wouldn't have had to go to court, but they decided, no, we're London Underground, which is what we're going to do. We're going to run our railway station how we like. They then came up with a whole load of things like best practical means in the court. They lost the case, and it cost them well over £100,000 to settle out of court. So people are quite interested these days in actually PA systems, and there's a lot of noise nuisance cases due to PA. The trouble is, on the one hand, we're actually trying to make the signal noise ratio to make it intelligible, and of course we cause noise nuisance. The two are completely there. So what we're trying to do, obviously, is to make sure that the signal, our speech signal, is over the top of the noise. That's not unreasonable, but not always to do. An easier way and a better way of seeing that is to, say, break it up into octave bands. And now you can then look at each octave band contribution. Because, in fact, what's important is that these are the bands that are important to clarity and intelligibility. These give you, here we've got the vowels, here we've got the consonants, roughly. That's where the intelligibility is. That's where the body and the rhythm and the naturalness of the speech comes from. But in fact, you can cut everything below kilohertz off and it's still totally intelligible. So that's a very good way of assessing intelligibility. In fact, you can do a reasonable measurement of it. There's a system that does that. If we look at direct reverberant, now what I mean here is the direct sound plus early reflections versus all the rest, the late stuff and the reverberant. There's a measure called C50, which concert hall acousticians use. It's quite useful. We need greater than 2 dB. I won't go into the details. It's basically the first 50 milliseconds versus the rest. So you take that ratio. And that works for music and it works for speech. In fact, for music, we'd actually move it around a little bit. But there's no real fixed scale. So nobody actually uses this in reality apart from the odd concert hall assessment. Freedom from echo, again, there's lots of criteria. Hass, you know, go back to 1949, did a lot of the work on it, and there's lots of papers ever since. Basically, you want to be 6 dB down after about 60 milliseconds, and it goes down at quite a rate. We are very sensitive to late arriving sound. But that's direction dependent as well, which you don't often see. Here's a classic. This is a concert hall with a sound system. Here's our direct sound. And so, I mean, you can never get the direct sound. I mean, it's this mystical object that we never actually get in reality, because there's always some early reflections coming with it, as you can see here. So there's some early reflections. That's good from intelligibility. They actually make it appear louder, and we have a higher direct reverberant ratio, effectively. So you go, oh, now this I knew had a problem. I mean, I must, you know, before I even did the measurement, we knew there was a problem. R1 here, you think, well, that's a problem. Look at that reflection sticking out there. No, that one, it was arriving within the kind of the integration time of the ear. It wasn't a problem. This was the problem. This was the ringer sitting out here. It was only 4 dB down at 200 milliseconds. You know, it's a long delay. But strangely enough, on speech, you didn't hear it as an echo. You just heard it as a blurring and a total loss of intelligibility. It was not an echo on speech. You play a tap dance or something, and you really do hear it as a separate event. And not only that, this was arriving not only late, but this was arriving back on the stage, and so you were trying to talk, and you couldn't. It was absolutely impossible. And this was the classic I told you so. This is a reflection off the back wall from the loudspeaker system. And I designed the loudspeaker system, and I said, unless you treat the back wall, we're going to have a problem. No, we won't. We've done this, we've computer modelled it, we've done this and other. Okay. So they build it, they had a problem. And within a week, we had a new back wall, how I actually had asked for it before. So people never learn. But we do know about reflections. It's a graph I designed some years ago, but we can tell when a reflection arrives, if it's going to integrate, if it's going to shift the image, if it's going to cause coloration. And it's quite a useful kind of graph. I won't go into it, but it's basically we don't want to be in the red area. You know, so if you've got a reflection at, say, 60 milliseconds, we want to be, well, in fact, this is for detection rather than annoyance. You want to be sort of 8 dB down. So it's quite a useful graph. And I'm working on systems that we can easily have 100 milliseconds, 120, 200 millisecond delays in them. And if you go outside, these are inside. If you go outside, you can get huge delays. I'm actually working on a project at the moment that has a 3-second delay on it. We've actually had to have special delays built and all sorts of stuff to actually give us a 3-second progressive delay. If I'm around for the London conference, you know it worked. If I'm not seen and I'm in Bolivia, you'll know it didn't. It's one of those, we've never done anything quite like it. It's bizarre. And we can look at, if you take that graph, we can look at cone filtering, image shifts in a bit more sort of detail. Won't go into it. Cone filtering, yeah, we all know about it. Stick a speaker next to a wall or a microphone next to a desk and you're going to get a cone filtering. Not only do you get an uneven response, you get the phasey-flamsy sound as well. That's not good, and that's a real speaker next to a real wall. The red curve was the original thing. So that happens. And there's nothing you can do, you know, even with clever DSP to really sort that out. Yes, we can remove the bumps, but you're not going to remove these dips. You can stick a boatload of power down there, it's just going to disappear again. It's a black hole in terms of, it's a phase cancellation. Not a good idea. Distortion, I don't know, less than 1%. Depends so much on what's causing it. You know, is it the loudspeaker, is it the amplifier? That's not my area, but certainly loudspeakers. People forget that actually a lot of distortion, we're not going to hear. It's masked because of the way the ear works. But it depends on what's going on. Anyway, that's a whole different area not to get into tonight. But looking at masking curves is really quite crucial. So we talked about that. There's a nice echo. Again, another one. What I'm interested in here is the reverberant decay. You know, we've got the direct sound, and then we've got all this energy that comes in afterwards that effectively will mask what we've heard, but will mask the next sound, more importantly. And I've come up with an interesting technique for seeing what happens. And from that, of course, we can measure the rev time. We smooth that out a little bit, filter it, put a line across it, and there's my reverberation time. And that's what reverberation time is. It's just the time that to decay over 60 dB or whatever it is. So, reverberation time criteria. For speech, it needs to be less than a second. But it's, room, again, size of room dependent. You know, small rooms, much shorter RTs than a larger room. Classrooms, for example, there's now a standard, this is becoming kind of international, less than 0.6 per second for primary school classrooms. That's reasonably dead. It's not much lighter than your living room. For bigger classrooms, for lecture theatres, maybe 0.8. Theatres, we would normally design for, you know, around about a second, 0.9. Jazz really needs, on the whole, depending on what it is, quite a short rev time. So that works well in theatres, not well in concert halls. Chamber music, maybe up to that. Opera gets quite lively. And then, you know, concert halls sit around about the 2 second mark. And the concert hall, actually, designing a sound system for a concert hall is the worst thing to do. Oh, sorry, it's the most difficult. You need high quality, and 2 seconds is not easy to actually overcome in that kind of space. They're probably the worst, most difficult call of that. I spend a lot of time playing around in churches and cathedrals as well as concert halls. And typically in the UK, they're about 3.5, 4 seconds. Most of them kind of come out. There's just a few. It varies. So they are, you know, tolerably reverberant. They're not humongously reverberant, but they are reverberant enough to make sure you have to do it properly. But you can get good results. What you don't want is this one, which is 8.5, 9 seconds in a cathedral. That's actually Liverpool Metropolitan. It's also round and circular and domed and does all sorts of things. The first reflection comes back after 120 milliseconds. So you hear nothing for 120 milliseconds, and it comes back louder than the direct sound because it's focused, because it's circular. I started working on that in 1984, which kind of dates me somewhat. I cracked it 2 years ago, and I did say in 1984, when I crack this problem, I'll retire, because if I can do this, I can do anything. I've still found challenges, so I'm still around, but not easy. Temporal distortion is another one I want to quickly talk about. This is the input signal. This is actually a sine sweep, constant amplitude. So we're just going up in frequency. That's what happens when you play it into a room. It looks nothing like it. You can see, you know, we lose the signal completely. That means at certain frequencies, you've got increasing frequency this way. So we actually lose it. So that's a constant amplitude signal. So your temporal signal, music, speech, is completely screwed in these kind of spaces. And yet we still manage to understand things and get information out. It's a question of what we can do with it. So in fact, this is going from high to low. So in fact, looking at that, you can say, well, the HF's there, the LF's got a big boost in it, and the mid frequencies have kind of gone down a bit. And that's exactly what happens. There's the frequency response of that system. This is in a very prestigious concert hall. It's a brand new system. It sounds very nice, actually. So again, how do I describe in my requirements that the system will actually have a 20 dB bass peak in it, please? And a bit of a bass boost, a high frequency boost and a mid cut. Sounds right in that room from a good system. So what do we do? I don't know. And that's on the balcony. Again, we've still got this huge... I mean, that really is a one-note bass, actually. That's not so clever. You really don't want that. But the acousticians, you know, they design the bass boost. So you then have to compete with it. And they go, oh, you can do it electronics. No, you can't. You can't cancel time. But what's interesting is that these days in not just concert halls, but large sort of venues, rock things, we are increasing the bottom end of the signal. You know, so we are boosting the bass because it sounds right. We do it in a nice controlled way, but generally it's that sort of curve. So we're actually adding a 10 dB boost on the bottom end, quite deliberately, on these systems to make them sound right. And in fact, down about the 60-80 disco beat, we might even put more in. This is for a normal system. This is not a disco or a rock system that's designed. This is a high-quality concert hall system, for example. Often you're competing with a bass rise that the acoustics people want. They're going to put in a 60% bass rise. That's great for music, the old cellos, you know, hammering away and the double bass. You try and play jazz in that and it's absolutely disastrous. Try and put a sound system in there. I can't get rid of that long reverberation time. I can cut the bass, but I can't get rid of the reverberation time. It's there. This was actually a theatre, and this sounded horrible. The rev time curve, it doesn't matter what you do, this one peaked at 250, had a major resonance problem in the room. There's just different ways of measuring reverberation time, but you can see here the peak. Anything more than about 10, 15, 20% rise is going to sound coloured. This is horrendous. Anyway, these things happen. But even Dolby, this is the curve for a Dolby dubbing theatre. I mean, these are incredibly tightly controlled things. Look at this, they're putting a 50% bass rise. But this is at the real low end. So, you know, 125, you know, we're putting in, this is the RT. So even now, we're still going to be putting in a bass rise, even in a home thing, or a Dolby dubbing suite. And interestingly, talking to a lot of people, we often put in a bass rise, even in a home listening or a home theatre. You still end up with this bass rise. It seems that we want this when we're in a space. You want the speaker itself to be pretty flat, but the overall response, you need something like that. Which gets quite interesting. Again, temporal distortion. This takes me back a long time. I was playing around with this about two decades plus ago, actually. Hence the black and white photographs. Again, tone burst in. This is what you get out. And this is in a room with a resonance problem. That one I can understand. This one I have no idea what was going on. I mean, it just shows that, you know, the acoustics will affect what you hear. And this was a, you know, domestic size listening room type room. Just hit the right frequency and you can get some really weird things going on. Now, I had an idea about that, because I was going to do some tone bursts, and thinking, well, that's actually quite complicated, and you don't really see what's going on. So then I had this idea. Take some pink noise and pulse it, and do it at about 4 hertz, and you get a thing like that. And you use this as a test signal, then you play that into a space. And it's really rather interesting. Now, the reason I use 4 hertz, it's very deliberate. That is round about the optimal frequency. I mean, when I'm talking to you, I'm modulating, you're hearing information about 4 hertz. 4 to 8 hertz is the primary thing for speech. It's about the same for music, funnily enough. So in fact, you're going to hear information around about the 4 to 8 hertz. Right now, 4 to 8 times a second, you have a new sound coming from me. So let's put that into a room. Okay, so let's play that into a room. This is in the living room. It's exactly the same signal. There's my, whoops, I don't want to do that. There's my signal. There's a result. You can see it, but now you can see the reverberant decay. Even in the living room, that's going on the whole time. So you're starting to lose information, depending on what goes on. Let's stick it into, this is actually in a modern church at about 1 second. Now, look at the information loss. You know, you can still make out the original signal, and as long as it's sticking up enough over the rest of the noise, if you like, you'll understand it and you'll get the information out of it. And let's stick it in, this is actually in a lecture theatre. Very intelligible, but it does sound quite lively. Again, you can see each of those individual peaks coming through. And, you know, visually you can start to do it. Equally, we can actually do a measure. We could actually measure this peak to kind of trough, you know, and that would give us a measure. That's the other end of the scale, 8 hertz. Again, you can still see it happening. Let's do it with speech, because it's easier with that now, because when you look at real speech, it's much more complicated to see what's going on. Look what happens in the lecture hall, it's only a second or so. You can just see the reverb adding in. Okay, on that, that's not a different one. But again, we've lost this information, we've lost the detail of what was being said at that point, due to the reverberation in the room. And it really is quite amazing how much of this we lose and how much information we still extract from these peaks in there. just for a laugh, that's the cathedral. All of this detail here is lost. Any quiet syllables, like, you know, if you say back or bad, the k sounds gone, the f and the s, completely gone. It's just masked by the next signal coming along. And that's, you know, when we're designing a system, we need to make sure that we don't need this, that's the anechoic speech, we certainly don't want that. That's, if we ever get the speakers wired up, I can play you what that sounds like. It's really quite interesting. Noise is dead easy. You just have a constant amplitude signal. And again, as long as you've got the speech or the signal information, the music over the noise, my Simpson noise ratio, that's fine, it's easy. And this is actually the concept between this is the concept between the STI, or the speech transmission index, which uses a modulated signal, and it measures the modulation actually coming in and out, but they're related to speech. It's just rather cleverer than my pink noise bursts or shape noise bursts. And there is an international standard for doing that, and there are ways of measuring STI. It's incredibly complicated because now what we're doing, just doing one frequency, we actually use 12 modulation frequencies over each of the octave bands. So we have 98 data points that all gets clubbed together and into a single number at the end of it. And like any single number, you have to be very careful, but it's actually a very good way of measuring intelligibility or potential intelligibility of a system. Right, changing to a slightly smaller space. I'm putting some of these ideas together. I measured my car system the other day, just because I... the hell of it. I measured the STI, which actually is ridiculous because it's, you know, you're sitting right on top of a loudspeaker. But I was interested in how I'd set the system up. I had a nice big bass peak, which you certainly can hear at times, no question, but it's not too overpowering. I was intrigued to see this thing at 1 kHz, which now I understand why I don't like certain records and things in the car. You really do hear that. But speech is clear. It does help a little bit there. So I was very relieved, actually, when I saw that, because now I understand why certain recordings I've done sound awful in the car. But it's not bad. It gets up to, you know, 15K. It's quite bad. It's not bad, really. And we can do various other measures on it. Distortion was interesting. Gets up to 20% at certain frequencies. It really is quite nasty. Some of those are resonances and rattles, I think, within the panels themselves, but it's interesting what you're listening to. As I now spend most of my life listening to stuff in the car, I really would quite like to know what I'm listening to. The other thing is, if you look at background noise level, I said we wanted 6 dB or so at least. And I was intrigued at what level I was playing stuff at, and also what the background noise was. And this is my spectrum. And you can see at the bottom end, this is on a particular program, they're about the same. In fact, the background noise at 63 is greater than the signal. 125, it's about the same. But above that, and certainly up here where the information, the clarity is, the speech information is, I'm well over it, you know, so that's good. That's why I can understand what's going on. And in fact, you can do more information than that. And in fact, I found I was playing at about 6 dBA signal-to-noise ratio consistently, which is kind of interesting. And I can get away with 6 because I've got such a high, good, you know, acoustic, there's no reverberant temporal loss. So it kind of works. You can also see why I've peaked the bass up, so I can actually improve. You know, that's with this big bass peak. I'm only getting the zero signal noise ratio. So you can see why you might want to do that. I'm going to skip through this because I'm running out of time, but as we get older, we lose hearing acuity, not just in terms of response, but it's also cognitive things. There's a lot of work going on this. Basically, the older you are, the better the signal you need. So I'm sorry, I'm going to skip through that because... I really haven't got time. That's a whole different talk some other time. We can use C80. This is, again, another direct reverberant measure as for music. You know, and we can actually say, well, organ music wants a fairly low direct reverberant ratio. You want more reverberant than direct. Symphony orchestras sort of, you know, around about zero in the middle. Then opera and speech, where you want to hear the information. And electronic music, where you want to hear the detail, is, you know, you need a very high, you need a good direct reverberant ratio or a low reverb time. The trouble is these days, they want to do all of these things in the same space, and it ain't going to happen. Certainly these ones are, the organ forget, but, you know, I'm working on two halls at the moment. They want symphony orchestra and they want this. Very difficult to do. The nice thing about STI, as I say with these single numbers, we can actually plot intelligibility or potential intelligibility, you know, throughout the whole thing. So I can do around, do lots of measurements, find a dead spot, see where the problem is, where do I need to improve it. I'm not just having to listen in every seat. I can do this in an evening, whip around and get a load of measurements. It's a very useful technique to do. And in fact, you'll see these are all actually pretty low. I mean, if this was a voice alarm system, it would fail. But it's empty. People learn how to speak in cathedrals. So you have to look at the thing. I came up with a new scale for this, which instead of taking numbers, we actually use colours and bands, which might be a bit easier to do. The trouble is, you see, contractually, I have to meet 0.5 for a voice alarm. And if I get 0.54, there he goes, that's wonderful, except the quantities are there. Says, well, you've overdone it. You know, we're going to sue you because you're too good. You've obviously spent more money than you need. The measurement tolerance is that. So I was trying to sort of reduce this by having a band. So in fact, I want a band F rather than what it is. And that's an idea I've managed to just about squeeze through the standards. And we could then have a list of, you know, what you wanted to do with it. That's the idea. I won't leave this up too long because these numbers have changed slightly. But it's the idea. Now, it'd be kind of neat, before we actually plugged the system in or installed it, if we could predict how good it was going to be, because that really is part of the thing. If you're going to spend 100,000 quid on a new sound system, or if you're doing a stadium these days, 500,000, it would be nice to know that it would work when you actually plug it in and do it. And it also keeps my blood pressure down slightly. So let's talk about how we might do some predictions. Obviously, they're irrelevant spaces. They're tricky. They're not that difficult. That's a nice diffuse space. Reasonably straightforward. People have been doing this for years without predicting it, and on the whole, once you've done a few, you get the hang of how to do it, you're away. I'm working on it at the moment. I probably won't do much prediction, but I know it will work. Let me just give you some... One of the problems I have is with architects and people. I'm just going to show you some analogies so that we can actually get through this. Just break it up a bit. I think most people realise that's not a very good installation in terms of a building. That has a problem. That one certainly has an interesting problem. These are real buildings, they're built. Sorry, it takes you a while. Sorry, I went too long with this. This one I like. I think they missed something out there. The analogy with sound systems is incredibly strong, actually. And that's what I love. I just think that's brilliant. Is it fit for purpose? I've got a couple more just to finish you off. I think this is a nice one. You know who your customer is and what they're actually going to do. And that one, I think, is fantastic. It looked all right on the drawing, Gov, you know, but not really so clever. Anyway. Oh, and there's always a fix, you know. I mean, as engineers, we learn to do this stuff sometimes. And, of course, obviously, headroom, we all know about. Or some people do and some people don't. You really do need to know about this. Anyway, sorry. So, and that one. How can you do that? I mean, people do that with loudspeakers all the time. I mean, but surely, you know. Anyway, lots of that. I want to whiz through predictions. If we know what the speaker's doing, at least we can aim it at the people and we can sort of work out the coverage. That's all quite straightforward. I was going to do a live demo, but I'm sort of running out rapidly out of time. But, you know, some speakers are nicely controlled. We look at the polars. These days, we look at a three-dimensional polar, if you like, and that's really useful. You can start to see where the sound's going. Like this thing. That's much more dramatic than the polar. I mean, this is a speaker from a very well-known and well-respected company. What on earth they designed that for, to do that? I mean, that's just asking for a disaster. This is the bit you point at the people and the audience. That's the bit that points at the microphone and goes straight into feedback. And that's the bit that goes at the ceiling and makes it rattle around and loses the intelligibility. Now, if you knew that, you wouldn't use that loudspeaker. So you do need to know what you're doing. Or you find out the hard way. You install 100 of them and find it doesn't work. So if you can... And then, you know, you look at the off-axis response as well, and that's an absolute feedback ringer, that one. So I'm going to whiz through some of these, but the three-dimensional one in colour really does start to hopefully make the point. Again, this one you need to be very careful of. At that frequency it's fine, but this one you really don't want to use that speaker. It's going to send the sound again, maybe in the wrong direction. Certainly up to a high ceiling you don't want to do that. This speaker is actually designed so it actually is not straight. You know, there's more sound coming below it, so it's trying to overcome certain problems. Beautiful speaker. Look at the control. It's just a way of different looking at control. This is, if you like, its coverage angle on this thing. So from 500 hertz upwards, beautiful control. That's what we kind of like to do. That's kind of reality. That's their drawing of it. This is the real measurement of a real kind of speaker. But again, this one works from way down from 250 up. It's a very narrow beam speaker. It's designed to do this. Works a treat. So again, if we've got the data these days, we can start to do it. Then we can start to plot the coverage. We can see this is actually a concert hall. This is the stage, so I want to keep the sound off here, so it's lower. But I can check. I'm only going to get, you know, 2 or 3 dB variation by using the right loudspeaker in the right place and doing all this beforehand. You know, this is before we even order the thing or try and design it. I can also measure the intelligibility. I can predict it. If I know something about the room, it's reverb time, it's volume and surfaces, I can tell if it's going to be intelligible or not. This is all very new. I can check the coverage in this one, again, and also the intelligibility. You go, well, okay, it's nice and red, why isn't this bit? Because I deliberately designed it, because that's where the microphone is, and that's where nobody sits. So I can take that into account, I can get myself some feedback control. So you can do all this. So, yeah, we use 3D models like this, and they really are quite useful. To understand these models, you can sort of look at this several ways. It's a bit done. We can render it these days. You can do that in Google SketchUp and actually do this thing in quite a, no time at all. And we can now do some predictions very easily. The programs are out there. We can do it. But even this simple modelling, I did this years ago, we can just check the coverage of each loudspeaker. Is it going to actually cover the area you want to do? Very simple. It gets a bit more complicated when you're doing a bigger stadium. There's a lot of loudspeakers there. But again, you can check that we've actually not got any dead spots, and what happens just from the speaker coverage. And then you can actually tell it to calculate what the real coverage is, and you can look at the variations. And that's just the direct sound. I'm not into the reverberant. So these days we can really do that. This is when you start to really get involved with it. This is the computer model we did for, it's actually an airport terminal with two different areas, two different stories. It gets pretty damn complicated, but we can predict that when they put the speakers in, it will work, and we can guarantee the performance. This is an underground station I said I was working on some. You wouldn't believe what goes on underneath and some of these things. And you can see, in fact, I can show you a simpler diagram of it. But we've got concourses, we've got escalators, we've got a ticket hall. This one actually has two different tube lines going around. All these are interconnected tunnels and things. All these speakers might be on, and they all interact. We need to know what goes on. So doing these models is incredibly complicated, actually. This one takes about 15 hours to run when we actually set it going. So the airport is. So we really do know what we want to do. We have standards for voice alarm, 0.5 STI, as I mentioned. There are no other standards out there, which is why I'm trying to introduce them, as to what standard do we need, what intelligibility, what clarity. And these are just some ideas I've been throwing around, and these are going to appear in this new standard, hopefully. Because we get a nice opera house like this. It's incredibly reflective. It's 1.5 seconds, so it's pretty reverberant. Yet they're going to do everything in here, from opera to comedians to everything else. And it has to look good. I mean, it's a beautiful looking space. You don't want to screw around with a damn great big array of speakers if you can do it. I was going to show you a photograph the other way, but you can't see the loudspeakers because they're completely hidden, so there's no point. But again, if you do it right. This is a 3.5 second nightmare space. Beautiful. But they want voice alarm. I have to do 0.5 in there. I can't do it unless I model it. I eventually have to go and do the measurements, see what's going on. A typical theatre, about a second. You really can't go wrong, You can, people do, and I make a living out of them doing it wrong. But in a second space, you can't screw the intelligibility that badly. It's not that, this is nice and dead, it's got seating in it, it's absorbing, you've got some panels on the wall. Aim the speaker. Now, the concert hall, completely different kettle of onions. 2 seconds, quite tricky, and they want high-quality sound. So we tend to use line arrays these days to focus the sound and direct it, and we can do some really nice, clever things these days with a line array system at a price. Cathedrals, again, we might use some sort of line array, maybe a common speaker of some sort, In fact, you can't even see the new ones, but those are the old ones. But you do need something that's fairly long and in the right place. And the further you get away, the less the intelligibility. So hence, when we're doing a theatre design, for example, you know, we want the sound to come from the stage. So we may have a speaker down here hidden away to lower the image, but most of the sound is going to come from up here, above the pros. But we're going to need some repeater ones at the back to actually do the job and fill it in. So these are going to be delayed and set up and synchronised, and the speakers under the balcony to cover in. Let me whiz through this. This just shows one technique. But imagine a big ballroom, lots of ceiling speakers. Here's the model. We splash sound everywhere. You know, the sound coming down from the high ceiling hits the walls, it goes everywhere. You just fill the whole place with sound. And you can make it intelligible if it's dead enough. It's not brilliant. If you use, when we calculated it, we got an SDI 0.44, which is borderline intelligibility. If you use the right loudspeaker, and you use a line array that then focuses the sound, suddenly we don't put the sound on the ceiling and the walls, we just put it on where the people want to go. So you aim the sound at the people. Oh my gosh, what a difference. Now you've got really good intelligibility. Massive improvement. So again, using the tools that are now available. And these things are, you know, these are kind of the arrays. These are electronic phased arrays. You can bend the beam electronically, you can put the speaker where you want. These can be 4 meters, 5 meters high to get the control. And this is, in fact, what we did in the big cathedral to get intelligible sound. There are four arrays of 4.5 meters, and this is 3.5, the small one. The small one's 3.5 meters, you know, the size of the speaker. Now you can do all sorts of stuff. And you can, you know, and architecturally, you have to blend them in. They kind of fit in quite well. Yes, you see them, but they look right within the space. The only trouble is they're behind the microphone. The speakers are actually back here. And of course, any idiot knows you can't possibly put a loudspeaker behind a microphone. It'll feedback straight away. Yeah, well, I'm just not an idiot. With a bit of care, I can stand that far back from the microphone. I'm 1.5 metres away, and I've got intelligible speech. I've got enough gain as well by designing the thing in. It took a lot of tuning and tweaking. It's doable. So there's no excuse these days for bad sound. There really isn't. It's a huge, it's a beautiful space, but my gosh, it's difficult. And in fact, you can get effectively constant intelligibility. That's what my graph is. From front to back, about the same, if you do it right. Often we do need to do something about the room. You know, the nice thing about the predictions are, and the nice thing, it's in colour, so you can talk to architects and other people who don't understand numbers. You can go, greeny blue, okay, red not good, blue not good. Which do you want? It's a bit of a no-brainer, but you'd think it would be, but it isn't. So basically, this is, you know, the difference between the two, and you can show them this is what's going to happen. I can even oralise it. I can actually, you know, listen to the sound in this space through the model and give people an idea. It's not what it's going to sound like exactly, but it gives you a clue as to what it is. And then when we really sorted it out, we could do that. You know, now we're quids in. They didn't go for it. They told, you know, so we said, it's not going to be good, it's in the report, all the rest of it, forget the numbers, look at the colours. No, we didn't budget for it. We're not putting it in. So they didn't. So in that airport, you've got to understand the word when they do an all call around that type of space. London Underground stations these days have set standards for intelligibility, would you believe, for their systems. This is the new ticket hall in a new station. That is an acoustic ceiling. I demanded it because in order to get the intelligibility, we had to get the reverberation time and control it down. And on the one hand, you can say, you want me to meet this standard to do that, you have to do this for me. And so now we have this dialogue going on. And we use standards and models to do that. This is Canary Wharf. There's absorption. This is absorption. This is all absorption in there to actually make it work. It would be a nightmare without it. We can predict it. We've been able to do this for years, but not quite the same accuracy in the same way. This is a shopping mall. That's absorption. You don't see it, but it's up there to try and control it so we can actually make the speakers work. I said line arrays are wonderful. They have problems as well. If you don't use them right, you can end up with a massive reflection coming back and hitting you. So again, it's like any tool. You know, you need to know how to use it. This is a room with attitude. I stupidly sorted out somebody else's circular room in the UK, and the next thing, about a year later, I get a phone call from the same guy saying, our associate company in Germany has a problem. It's a bit like ours. Can you go over to wherever it is and have a look at it? Basically, this is a dome circular room, very reverberant, and it's a food court. So you just hear the clatter of knives and forks. It's a hard floor because it has to be cleaned. It is a nightmare. And you can see here, these are 2 5-metre line arrays we're going to use. And in between them is a big video screen that they paid £500,000 for, and they're going to advertise on it. And people won't be able to hear the advert, because putting it on the screen, people take no notice. But if you can hear it, magic. We're going, it ain't going to work. And so a lot of modelling, a lot of computer time actually, you know, spent for this thing, trying to come up with solutions, showing people what goes on. But whenever I see a circular room, I really ought to duck. I mean, this gives you an idea of the sort of size of it. It's all glass, hard plasterboard, going in the middle of doing it. We've got some treatment in, but not as I'd like. This is actually, and this is in state. There's the direct, there's the echo. You know, we can predict that fairly easily. I guess we'd probably like that. That's an idea of a good room. That's the idea of an architect's good room. It really is a bit like that. The two will never meet sometimes, and I have argued blue in the face about some of this stuff. That is the architect's absolute ideal, and that is about the worst thing you can possibly do. It's reverberant, and you've got a white noise generator in here just to sort of really make it more difficult. You just don't want to do that stuff. This is a stunning-looking church. They missed all the acoustic treatment out because it can't support the look on the walls, so they have hard plaster. And you can't understand a word. You know, told you so. I just want to quickly finish on some loudspeaker interactions. Even if we do all this clever stuff, we still get caught. In a theatre like this, there's a cluster here actually, and there's some speakers on the side. Very typical, are we going to do left, right, centre, or just left and right? You need at least 2 boxes next to each other to be able to work. And these things interact. You know, you might have a cluster looking something like this. In reality, you can't get the speakers, you can get trapezoidal boxes, but you still can't actually get them. You're going to have spaces between them. And you're going to have interference. You know, you've got different sources, the same frequency, separated. You're going to get interference. There are manufacturers out there saying their speakers don't interfere with each other. Absolute lying through the backsides. They do. And you can predict it. I mean, just to give an idea, I mean, this, and also depends on how good your program is. This is that cluster at 200 Hz. Now, this is using it a traditional way. It goes, oh, yeah, I've got lovely coverage. Wonderful. This is doing it if you actually use a phase information in the speakers. And you can see it's starting to narrow down. So, you know, the sides are going to be different. So you're starting to get a hot spot down the middle. At 300, we start to lobe. If you use a cheap program, you're going to get that and think everything's wonderful. You use the £4,000 program or the £2,000 program, and you start to see life a bit different, and so on. And then you go, I wonder why I'm using 3 speakers to try and do this job, because I'm building in problems, but if I don't put them in, I don't get coverage. So you're caught between, you know, a rock and a hard place. But at least if you know roughly what's going to happen, you can start to prevent it. And I think that's wonderful. That's Doctor Who stuff, isn't it? That's what will happen. Line arrays are a whole different thing. I say we use these. These have become the flavour of the month. Everybody wants a line array, even if it's suitable or not. In a whole big hall like this, it's the perfect solution. It's the right way to do it. In fact, you can hardly see it, but it's a bit smaller than that, but it's the right thing. Works a treat. But they do all sorts of weird things. You're putting lots of sources together. They're going to interfere. That's what, how they're designed. That's what they do. And the idea is you do that to advantage. You have these under control. You use the beam where you want the sound. And you can, you know, get something like that. And it's remarkable. You just change the boxes slightly. You take the same boxes, you just angle them slightly differently, and suddenly you can get a really nice control beam like that. All we did is just change the spacing of the boxes and the way they're angled. It's incredible. And we can extend the thing. So that's obviously what we try and do. You don't really want to do that. You often see these hanging up in the reason. They're called J arrays because of the shape. If you do it wrong, you end up with this absolute nightmare of sound like that. It does it. You do it right, and then you can start to get some control. And again, this is all predictable. Lots of people make programs for it, so it's all doable. So we know it's going to be a problem or not, and we should do. just finish on, but this was what the talk was going to be about. So it's taken me an hour and a quarter to get there, but this is next year's talk when I come back. Trying to get decent bass in the theatre is quite tricky. Often we just end up, you know, with a couple of bass either side on the stage or underneath here somewhere. And you end up with a thing called power alley. Right down the middle, you end up with excess bass. A way around it is, say, to distribute the bass. Or in some cases you can do that, other cases you can't. It very much depends, and this is just an experiment we were playing around with to see what it was like. We also did some predictions. There's the two speakers either side the stage, and you can see this thing called power alley. Now, if you've got a central aisle, that's fine, because they get all the bass, but these people on either side don't get any bass at all. It's 100 hertz. You just don't get it. Go to 125, 250, again, you get this thing. And that's why, as you go from seat to seat at low frequency, you get these tremendous variations going on. And this is without the room. This is just the speakers separated by this distance. Now you put the room in there, and, you know, all bets are off. And there's no real software that will sort this out yet. So I can't even, you know, really predict it very well. I can predict certain of it. Now we look at those five across the front. Again, you know, it looks very even. But I'm getting some control. Again, if I put the phase information in, but it's a lot better than it was. It's not, you know, it's not got the power alley thing. It's not got the lobes. But my gosh, it can do as you go up. Again, you get the same thing. So when we've got sources, even at low frequencies, and they're that sort of distance apart, we're going to end up with lobing. We know what's going to happen. And there are some ways around it. These days, cardioid bass are coming out in concerts. Literally, you have, you know, two speakers, one behind the other. One's slightly out of phase, a different angle. And now we can actually keep the bass off the stage. And we can also control it much better into the audience. And you can get tremendous gain now on feedback. Because bass was always the problem with gain before feedback. By using cardioid arrays, depending where we go. And that most concerts these days will be going that way. And installations are going this way as well. But of course it costs. You know, it's double the amount of speakers, double the amount of amplifiers. And the one of them isn't really doing anything, you know, effectively. It's not producing the sound out the front, but it's doing the control. And that's kind of where things are going. It also makes the bass quality quite different. It tightens it up, is the best way of explaining that. I guess, you know, cardioid bass, dipole bass in rooms has been known about for quite a while. But it's only just now doing this in theatres and concert halls and touring things. But that's where it's going. You can do even cleverer things. You can do all sorts of things now with DSP. And things. But again, we could predict what's going to happen beforehand within reason, but not too much. The question is, what in fact should the curve be? What's the psychoacoustics behind it? I haven't got an analyzer that tells me yet this is what we want. You have to trust your ears and a lot of experience. And on that happy note, I will leave it. Thank you, Keith. It's a bit longer than I expected, so sorry about that.
Peter, I suggest what we do is, as you know, Peter's got a couple of demonstrations, audio demonstrations that he can give to us, if we get the speaker set up. But bearing in mind what the time is and the fact that some of you might be wanting to catch trains or otherwise get on your way, I suggest we do the Q&A now, and then those of you who are interested to stay on for the demonstrations, the audio demonstrations, can stay on after the Q&A. Yeah,
yes,
if there's anybody left, Peter will put it on.
Yeah, yes. Can do it. If not,
okay,
then.
Good. No fine. So, as usual, I'll ask you to use a microphone, please, when you ask a question so that we can get it on the recording before Peter gives his answer. Any questions?
Yeah, you mentioned about the X curve for cinema sound at the start, but could you just explain why there is that high frequency roll off on there?
Right, well, it comes down to the fact when I showed you the loudspeaker, you know, the flat response of it, and then when you measured it in the room, it's really the power response is what you're doing. If you make that thing flat, if you imagine on axis, it's flat. Everywhere else off axis, you're losing energy, and therefore what's going to happen is you make it flat on, you know, one place, the on axis is going to have a huge peak in it. And it's really to do with the diffuse sound field. It's really what you're listening to is not just the direct sound from the loudspeaker, it's all the reflections as well in the room. And although in a, you know, in a cinema they're fairly well controlled and they're fairly dead, if you make it too flat, It just sounds too shrill. It's as simple as that. It's a thing to do with large spaces. You know, it doesn't quite work in a living room. Here you can have it flat because you're in a different kind of space. It also has to do, that's part of the answer. The other thing is also, if you look at the ear's response, and it's the ear's diffuse response, it's now going to pick up over a much wider area, but a huge peak in the high frequency end, and it also has to do with that. So in fact, although that's doing that, what your ear's hearing is actually much flatter. And it seems to have to do with a large space. I can't... All I can say is that when you measure the speaker, that would be dead flat itself. It's just a combination of the two.
I'd like to ask, if I may slip in, two questions or question and a comment. I noticed that in many public places and also on things like trains, the PA is getting very aggressive these days. There seems to be an awful lot more hard mid, and levels are going up to the point where it's quite actually distressing at times. I wonder if there is a what you might call a ground reason for this, a common reason. And the other comment is that having quite frequently transited through Paddington Station, cannot understand a word practically. It's still the old thing of put the loudspeakers high up in the roof so that by the time the sound gets down to the people on the concourse, there's as much reverb as there is direct and literally cannot understand what's being said. How can they still get away with this in view of the regulations you mentioned?
Let's answer the first question because that's probably easy. Yes, I agree with you. They are getting more aggressive and loud, too loud. I mean, in the last year, I'm becoming more conscious of how loud some of these systems have become, and to the point that they're annoying. The trouble is that the Network Rail, or whatever they call themselves this week, London Underground, have set a standard, and it says that the PA system will be 10 dBA above the ambient noise level. And they actually, what you do is you put a tracking device on so it actually looks at the noise level and it backs it up. And it actually says a minimum of 10, not another thing. And so they are being hoiked up, so it's 10 over. And you don't need it under a lot of conditions, certainly not under a train or something, as I showed. You don't need that level of thing. The other thing is they forget is once you go above about 80 dBA, you actually start to lose intelligibility. Just the ear function, there's a loss. So in fact, you really don't want to do that. But because, and this is where it comes contractual, the specification and the requirement from LUL or whoever it is says, you will do this, that's what you do if you want to get paid. The fact that it doesn't sound right, I can make it sound better. I mean, I literally had a discussion with Tube Lines. We were talking about the whole thing, and they go, no, you might be able to make it sound better, but does it meet the numbers? Can we tick the box? And I might make it sound better, but then it wouldn't meet the numbers. So you can't tick the box, you don't do that.
So can you rewrite the standard? Yes.
Well, I mean, but this is part of the talk as to what do we do? You know, I mean, it's rather more complicated than, you know, we've taken the first step, and it's the old pendulum. You know, we've gone too far, now we need to come back. But where do we actually put the line? And that's what some of this work is sort of relating to, as to where it goes. To answer your second question, Paddington, I haven't been into there for a while, but yes. But then you have a thing called English Heritage. And, I mean, that's the other trouble working in cathedrals and other places. They're mostly Grade 1 listed buildings, and you can, you know, you just can't put the speakers necessarily where you want to. But there's no reason these days. I thought Paddington had got some of these really long 5-metre line arrays, and those work. You can actually shoot it down. King's Cross has got it. Not King's Cross. Or Euston. You know, 30, 40 metres away, you're in the beam and you can make it work. I did a job, Network Rail are obviously very cotton onto this and they're very pleased about it, so I did a job for somebody. This was in a room about half its height, so it was a huge space. And again, we had a contractual requirement to meet 0.5 SDR, some intelligibility level. I did some calcs and said, it can't be done. You know, it just isn't going to happen. So you go in for a meeting and you go all doom and gloom and say, well, I can make it work, but you're going to have to give me 4,000 square metres of acoustic fuzz on the roof at whatever that cost is. And it was about $250,000 or something they were saying to make it work. Then I can make it work. Unless you do that, all bets are off. And this guy says, haven't you heard about these line arrays that do this? They work a treat. And I go, the floor to ceiling of where we can mount these is 2.5 metres. These things are 5 metres. What do you do with the other 2.5 metres that stick out the top of the bloody tunnel or something, you know, whatever. I didn't put it quite as politely as that, but I mean, yeah. Yes, the technology is there, but you have to use it in the right place. You know, so again, I mean, a lot of railway stations are now using line arrays, and in fact, there's some arrays that not just do the vertical coverage; they do the horizontal coverage. So in fact, you do get a beam both ways, and work quite well at a cost. You know, these things are full of DSP, full of drive units and amplifiers. They're not cheap. You're looking at 10, 15 grand per speaker. At least, but it's doable. It's quite doable.
I've recently got interested in a lot of people are applying FIR techniques to correcting problems in small listening rooms with massive claims, which I tend to be sceptical about, but. There's some interesting claims going on. In your experience, is any of this correction really viable, and could it be applied to bigger spaces?
It's right. Depends what you're trying to correct. If you're trying to check the general response of the curve, then yes, I think that's quite doable. But again, you're not going to get rid of, you know, people speaking against the one who's got these cone filters going on, you're not going to sort that dip out. And again, what kind of criterion curve do you actually put on this thing? It's an area, funny, if I'm playing around with, I've got a device at home that I'm actually playing around with to see what it does and what rules it's kind of going on. But again, if you screw up, all you can do is you've got your direct sound. If you screw that up too much, the ear's going to know about it, and that's the point. And it's a question of the less of the two evils. In bigger spaces, I've got a lot more scope for it. I have to screw the response up. I've done dreadful things to the direct sound to make it, and it looks right and it sounds right. You couldn't get away with that in a small dead room, but for sure. It would sound dreadful. And it all comes down to this integration thing of the ear. What do we really hear? You know, how much of the direct, how much reflected, that affects it, and where does the quality come from? I think there's a lot of scope, and I think there's good. People have been working on this idea. I was working on researching that idea, funnily enough, 30 years ago. Yeah, I'm getting on for that. Maybe 29. And I can remember thinking at the time, when we get the 1 megahertz processor, we can crack this. We haven't cracked it yet, but we're getting close to it. I mean, it's, do single point, omni-mic. I mentioned earlier, I'm doing a lot of work now with binaural measurements and stuff. I haven't got a clue to do what the data are. I can get all these wonderful measurements. I don't know what to do with the data when I've got it. And sometimes I get the right answer, sometimes I don't. And we're ending up doing some tremendous cross-correlations between the two ears and doing clever stuff with it. I still, I spend hours doing this thing and go, the answer's a lemon. Now what do I do? For example, intelligibility. We all listen with two ears. If you go, monaural listening, all the intelligibility requirements and standards were written for monaural listening, not binaural. So there's they're always spelling safe, actually, as a criterion. So, in fact, one of the things we're doing in the standard is to put it in. But to actually measure binaurally is incredibly complicated. I've got two binaural heads that I've kind of acquired over the years, and I borrowed another one. They all give different answers. So now what you do? We have to have a standard binaural head. Well, Mr. B&K is not going to talk to Mr. GRAS and Mr. Head Acoustics when they spend all this money on these things. And they cost, thousands. And everybody's ears different. It's not unreasonable. We all hear differently. So now we're going to have a standard head and a standard set of ears, which, it's like headphone measurements. Different ears will give different results in how you do it. So that's a whole new thing, future for, to go. But certainly binaural measurements are going to be interesting. And that's where some of the future is going to be. I don't know what to do with a diffuse response. I really don't know what to do with it. Because in some cases, it's clearly in the measurement and it's clearly important. Other times it doesn't seem to be. I just wish I knew what the hell to measure, then we'd all be a lot happier. It's like it off my chest. It's brilliant, actually.
I assume from the way you've described some of the measurements that you've taken that in most cases you take them with the room empty or the space is empty.
Yeah.
I could imagine that for a concert hall perhaps, or at least where there might be a critical mass of people, that it would have a fairly significant bearing on the measurements that you take, and then ultimately leads on to the fact, how do you set up a system and then maybe sell half the tickets and the place is half empty and it sounds bad?
That's a good question. Obviously, if we're going to model it, we can predict it full and empty, so that takes some of it into account. If you get the direct sound right, and it's, I won't say it's dominant, but it's actually pretty powerful, then in fact the effect of the people is reduced, so it doesn't change as much. Some of these places don't change as much as you actually might think. But if you take a reverberant cathedral, I mean, the RT can go down by half. It can go from 4.5 seconds to 2 or something. Football stadiums are classic. I've actually measured. I actually got some 65,000 people in a football stadium, and I actually did some measurements with them in there. I won't tell you I did it, but... Well, yeah, but you try and get 65,000 football. I mean, it's bad enough. On this one occasion, it was doable. And in fact, the rev time went down from sort of 3.5 to 1.8 seconds. So it made a heck of a... Derek makes a really big difference. It really does. So in fact, the trouble is, it's very difficult. You set it up so maybe it's a bit bright, so that when it does fill up with people, so you have to go to the concert and you listen, and then that's when you tweak it. And any decent, concert operator is going to be walking around, or somebody will be walking around and have a listen to what happens. But you do try and maximise the direct and early reflect. Well, see, it's a nice big space. You don't get early reflected because there's nothing around it. Go to O2. There's nothing for miles around in the arena. Yards around the array. So in fact, it is really direct sound, and it's also pretty damn dead in there as well. They've actually designed it for that environment. There's an awful lot of absorption, say in O2, because it's done for amplified music. Now you're doing a concert hall, and that's why I say they're the killers, because they're designed to be reflective and to actually have sound. And the trouble is, you design a concert hall from an acoustics point of view, from all the orchestra, all the orchestra on the stage, the sound's going that way. My speaker's up here, it's coming this way, so it hits in a completely opposite direction. So they may design a surface to reflect the sound one way, I go and hit it in the wrong way. And try and explain that. And so we have these, it's quite complicated. My job starts when the acoustician finishes, and it's because I can do their job, because I'm an acoustician, that actually we get on and actually get the thing sorted. And because I can argue with them equally, they can't pull the wool over my eyes. So in fact, sometimes we win, sometimes we lose, because they don't like talking to me sometimes because of that. But yeah, it's a big chase. I mean, a whole new talk is actually how you do measurements in occupied spaces, and that's becoming viable. It is becoming viable to do that with some clever processing these days.
Of course, you can argue that in a properly designed opera house and properly trained singers, you shouldn't need any sound reinforcements.
Well, I'd agree in something like opera. But also, that these days, most of the new buildings are not purpose designed. I mean, there are exceptions, but they're going to be multi-purpose, so then you do. I mean, the one, the last timber one I showed you, it's a multi-purpose. 3 months of the year it does opera, the rest of the time it has to earn a living by doing anything that's going, from sort of conferences, comedy, jazz, folk. I know they do drama in it, but they do a lot of speech and spoken word, actually. Funny enough, they do have a festival of speech. So it has to do all of these things. And, when you look at the rev times that you really need, you should need different buildings for different genres. But, we're lucky to get concerts and theatre. A lot of multi-purpose halls. I'm working in two theatres at the moment. Both of them have got electroacoustic reverberation systems in them to actually increase the RT for music when it comes in.
Well, the other thing, of course, is instead of spending all this money on sound reinforcements, perhaps you should develop a system for direct injection into the brain.
To a certain extent, but this has been around. Well, I mean, the Festival Hall was one of the very first to do that back in the 1960s because it was too dead. The assistive reverberation system. But that system was then used in, maybe 15, 20 places around the world, and it was all right in its day, but it was very clever, but it really didn't do what was required. Other systems have now come out, and it's interestingly that they're not that widely used. I mean, you're looking at doing, say, a theatre or something, say a 1,500-seat theatre, so a reasonable size that would pay. You're looking at 250,000, you're looking at £250,000 for one of these systems by the time it's installed. It's 200,000 quid off the back of the lorry and then another 50,000 to actually get the cables and hoik it up into space and do stuff with it. Something like that. Even more, actually. So it's a lot of money, and frankly, if you were a half-decent acoustician, you could actually do it otherwise. You can do it mechanically. A lot of halls actually bring in drapes, bring in variable absorption, and do it that way. You can't get the same range, but it's doable. And a lot of musicians and orchestras don't like an electronic system. You know, there has been problems in the past, but these days they're pretty sophisticated and pretty reliable and pretty good. And there are, four or five competing systems around the world, but the fraction of, the percentage that they go into is very small in terms of theatres. Maybe it'll get more, I don't know. But it's, when you're spending a quarter of a million quid, you kind of think twice and think what else you might spend the money on. A bigger bar is usually the wins, often. Gold-plated taps or wherever it is, I'm working, funnily enough, on two at the moment, one I've designed and the other one I have put the sound system in, so I'll be very interested to see how it kind of works out. That's the first two I've worked on in 10 years, over here, so it's not very common. They're a fair rarity. And you think trying to specify a sound system is bad enough, you try and specify one of those, it's quite interesting, isn't it?
Peter, I've got a question about oralisation, which you mentioned just in passing.
Yes, sorry about that.
Am I right to imagine that actually it's not a great deal of interest to you, other than potentially to give some of your clients an indication of just how bad a problem is? Because I would imagine that as far as you're concerned, it tells you something you already know. You already know from the other work, modelling work you've done, that you've got a problem. And more importantly, it doesn't tell you how to fix it.
No, that's true. It's a very nice communication. It's ridiculous that we're talking about audio and yet we don't listen to it or whatever. We show pictures of it. Showing a picture is a damn sight better than putting a number on it. Yes, the numbers tell me I've got a problem, but they're not always. The trouble is with the oralisation, it will tell you if there's a gross, it's a first order of magnitude type approach. So just as the numbers are. You have to be very careful. I mean, I've listened to the same building oralised with two different programmes, and it sounded radically different. So then it's a question of which was the right programme and what was going on and what did it tell you. As I showed you in some of these sort of examples of these things, I only found out recently that there's three major programmes out there that you can do this sort of thing with. And I'm fairly sure, but one of them for sure, and I think the second one as well, does not actually compute that in the oralisation. So you don't get all that stuff going on. Therefore, you don't get the beams going in various places. You don't get half the information. So I'm very sceptical as to what you listen to. It's very easy to fool yourself in these things.
So if they get oralisation right one day, will you find it useful?
I think it will, absolutely. I mean, as a communication tool. And also, you listen to it like... You say it doesn't work, or you don't know the answer. If you listen to something like an echo in speech, it's very useful to know, how many dB do I need to drop that by? If I could reduce that echo by, say, 3 dB, would that fix the problem? If I can drop it by 3, that means I can put some absorption on the wall, I can do it that way. If I want 10 dB off it, then I've got to redesign the building, or I've got to do something absolutely drastic. So actually listening to that is quite useful. But you have to listen to it very carefully as like an engineer, not a musician or an architect or any client. You have to use the tool as it's meant. That's quite useful, and that's actually quite fun to do. You can do that quite easily, actually, these days with stuff. I can cheat beautifully on that. You can do all sorts of stuff in SoundForge and Centurion. It's more and more, actually. It's becoming more and more. Then the question is, do we listen to it in stereo? Do we listen to it on headphones? Do we do it in ambisonics? All those things. If it's on headphones, of course you lose all of the moving around, all of that stuff's going. That's why I think some of the interesting work's going on. And these days, some of the concert halls are now being oralised. You listen to major problems, basically.
Any other questions, anyone? One more.
Thanks. It's sort of an STI question. If I'm at a convention, basically I'm a practicing sound engineer, and put a sound system in for a conference in a conference hall for a set for, say, a five-day event or something like that. Everything's absolutely fine. I don't necessarily get to choose the equipment, and I certainly can't choose the acoustics, yeah. So you make the best of it that you can. And everybody's absolutely fine when they're speaking in their first language. But when they're speaking in their second language, you'll start having problems. And I'm actually thinking, well, even where we've got presenters, which I'm understanding, because they're talking in their first language, we've got delegates who are listening in their second language. Would one have better success in intelligibility with a higher SDI? Does it take into account language in any, you know, the language people use?
The quick answer is yes. And in fact, roughly speaking, for a second language, and it doesn't mean if you're talking in it or listening to it, depending which way, you need about a 4 dB improvement for about a 0.1 SDI uplift. So if let's say we're designing 0.6 for a conference centre or something like that, you've got to do 0.7. You may not be able to achieve that, actually. I mean, you may be struggling to even achieve those numbers, but that's what you need to do. So, you need about a 0.1 improvement to equate the thing. So, yes, the answer is...
Right, so basically, if the national standard that the hall's designed to is, say, 0.5, and you're doing an international conference, everybody's got a problem.
Yeah. I mean, the other trouble is that, as I said, the other thing is STI is a monaural, effectively, or it's a... It was two ears, but same signal, so whether it's dichotic or I can't remember which one it is anyway. When you listen binaurally in a reverberant space, then in fact you get an advantage. You actually do a correlation. And in fact, it turns out that you actually, if you measure SDI binaurally, which I've spent a lot of time doing lately, you actually look at the best ear. And in fact, you can take the information from the best ear and use that.
Right. So it's the whole taking into account the whole learning... The way the brain and the ear learns.
That was great until I read a paper recently that actually suggested that you listen. I can't remember which way around it is, but you listen to music with the left side. You know, music and speech are different sides of the brain, and they're actually showing that different left and right ears actually listen as well. It's a wonderful theory by this guy. I don't know. You know, I think that's pushing it, but certainly, the 0.5, funnily enough, is everybody's hooked onto that for whatever reason. And it's a pretty good standard. I mean, initially, actually, I thought it was very high. But I kind of got used to it. Because that's really 0.6 when you're listening binaurally. The whole scale moves by about roughly 0.1 between binaural and monaural listening. Equally, if you can see me speaking now, you're getting about 20% more intelligibility because you can see me... My lips move, my body language, the whole thing. It's amazing. You wouldn't believe how much information you're gaining from that. And it's about 20% more information. So again, the PA system is, you've lost the 20% to start with. So it's all those things as well. And the interesting thing is, it's also the same with age, not just second language, but children. Like in primary school, you need a much better acoustic or a much better sound system in primary than you do in secondary. Because up to about the age of 13, 14, your brain is still working out language. It still can't cope with things. It's still working things out in a completely different way. So like an 8-year-old listens to speech completely differently to a 14-year-old or to an adult. So you need a higher standard for children. And as you get older, you start to lose information. You've got hearing loss. Your cognitive processes do slow down. And what's happening, but in fact, when you do some of these tests, you find that 50, 60, 70-year-olds are doing just as well as younger people. But they're using all of their experience of language and skill to work out what was said, because they can do that. And in fact, they do just as well in these tests. But what happens is that's why they're slower, and sometimes you ask an elderly person a question, and then you get a reply. It's not instant. What is happening is that cognitive load on the brain, because they're working every trick in the book out to work out what was said. You know, from that sentence, did he say, if I said I walked down the lane? No, he said he walked down the lane, not the lane. So it's obvious in that context, but other things. So you're putting the thing into context. So under good conditions, funnily enough, you get the same cognition between, even some hearing impaired and other people. Soon as the conditions get bad, as soon as we start to have single noise ratio problems or reverberant problems, that's when it starts to fall apart, and that's when they really start to sort of lose it out, and they never quite gain it. I mean, that's a whole different talk.
Yes, and Peter, we've got to stop me, I'm afraid.
Sorry about that.
Yes.
And this is talking about sound intelligibility.
Yes.
It's very interesting. Back here, I can understand every single questioner who has his back to me far better than Peter.
Well, nobody understands me anyway.
So, just as an experiment, could you give the microphone to Peter?
Yes.
To just answer a very quick question, which is,
shall I do this with my back to you as well, Roger?
Yeah,
yeah, but this microphone's louder than that one.
Well, that's what we've got to sort out.
So, I mean, that's the level.
Hands up who agrees with me that it's been easier to understand the questions than it has to be to hear Peter.
Yeah, I mean, I'm
so,
not...
So I think this is something we have to address, Peter, because, you know, everything, we're really struggling to hear you, whereas... No, when you've got the microphone, it's quite easy. But I did have one question, which is, you talked about the voice versus background noise. Is it much worse if the background noise is something that the listener can understand, like a cocktail party effect, than a lot of random noise, which is not going to interfere with his understanding?
Yes. The trouble is, yes, if there's information in the noise, then you try and listen to the information as well, which is part of it.
Right.
So it also depends on the spectrum of the noise. I mean, the worst interfering noise is something that's either got about the same spectrum of speech or something that masks it. So something like white noise or a fountain is a killer because it's got a lot of high-frequency noise. Luckily, most natural noises are low-frequency biased, you know, so traffic noise, train noise and that sort of stuff, or the squeal, has got more low-frequency, and like in the car, if you look at the spectrum of the noise, it's all low-frequency biased and the highs are going down, so you tend to actually be okay. So if you like the same signal-to-noise ratio in DBA, you can have completely different intelligibility depending on the spectrum. But yes, if there's information content in the noise, then... You can do it, but you say the cocktail party effect, you've probably got zero signal to dB noise ratio, maybe minus six or something, yet you hear your name or you hear that information. You can concentrate, if you concentrate, you can concentrate on a particular voice on that. So, I mean, how the hell do you measure that? You know, that's just impossible.
It is interesting, very often I can't hear someone who's quite close to me, yet I can hear someone right over the other side of the room.
Hmm.
Well, that might be training, I don't know, to listen.
Don't know. But then, you know, generally we tend to face speak, you know, we face people when we're talking to them, you know, when you have got difficulty, you always look, but then you're getting the visual information as well, to a certain extent. I mean, if you look at your ear, the maximum sensitivity is about 45 degrees at sort of high frequencies. So in fact, you've got two working together straight on that gives you this other thing. So yes, it could be, you know, maybe one ear is better than the other, I don't, you know, so as you get older, that happens as well. You know, I've got a lot more loss in my left ear than in the right. So maybe by turning that way, I orientate my hearing that way. I don't know. It's possible. Should we have a conference on noise and hearing?
I'm sorry if I've misled any of you, but we won't have the chance to hear the audio demonstrations, I'm afraid, because we've run out of time. So, but thank you for remaining and asking a series of questions that have kept us going for so long. Peter, thank you very much for coming along. As usual, we see to you.
The sad thing is, one of the things we could have demonstrated was measuring the intelligibility from front to back, but we won't do that.
Some other time. Thank you, Peter.